region or have another print disability which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Patricia Mary, and for the next hour, I will be reading from the August 8th and 9th issue of Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the front page of Off Duty, Off Duty Travel by Lane Florshine. It's easier than ever to fly private without your own jet. The options are multiplying if you're willing to pay a premium to avoid commercial travel. Heated stone floors, walls covered in silk and cashmere blend, a circadian rhythm-based lighting system to ease jet lag. These are among the ultra-luxury amenities coming to every aircraft in the fleet of Bond, a new members club offering access to private jets. A stake in a Bond jet costs at least $3.7 million plus additional fees. Although the company won't begin flying until next year, it already has signed up 110 members. There are now some 430,000 households worth $30 million or more in America. As the number of multimillionaires has grown, so too has the amount of services for high net worth individuals looking to avoid the indignities of commercial travel. An average of 295,000 private flights took off per month between January and June, up 15.4% from the same period in 2019, according to the data from the aviation service company Argus Tepec. The average cost of a one-way first-class ticket between New York and Los Angeles from January to May 2026 was $974. Not including taxes and fees, according to the aviation analytics company Circum. For many who want to opt out of commercial flying, owning a plane is impractical. New jets on the smaller end, like the 7 to 11 seat Embraer Phenom 300, can cost around $14 million, while annual maintenance, staffing, and other costs for planes of that size can add another $1 million, according to JIQ by JetNet, a business that tracks aviation industry data. Companies both new and established are stepping in with other options at a range of price points, from fractional jet ownership and jet pooling services to programs that let you book private terminals at major airports. Together, they are increasing the path to flying private or private enough. The Intimate Private Flight Club. Bond founder Bill Panella started his new aviation business after founding another, the charter company Jet Edge. He's positioning Bond as an alternative to NetJet and FlexJet, decades-old companies that popularize fractional jet ownership. The model evokes that of a timeshare. You're splitting custody of a plane, and you're guaranteed a certain amount of time on that plane. As co-owner, there are additional benefits that can include tax write-offs. The Bond pitch is a member club offering a cozier take on fractional jet ownership. The cost is between $3.7 and $12 million to co-owner a Bombardier jet with no more than 8 people, plus $1.1 to $1.7 million in operating fees. What you get for that millions of millions? 100 hours in the air annually on domestic and international flights aboard your shared jet, along with other benefits that include tax write-offs. Bill says that the number one request among Bond members are for jets to have fewer co-owners than they can at other companies. Bond planes will have no more than 8, while FlexJet and NetJet can allow for twice as many owners per aircraft. When Bond begins flying domestically and internationally next year, it will have 18 Bombardier jets in operation, a number that is meant to grow to 120. Models include smaller Challenger 3500, mid-size Global 6500s, and larger Global 8000s. FlexJet currently has 340 jets in its network and NetJets more than 1,100. Their fleets include Bombardier planes and other models. To maintain Bond's jet-to-owner ratio, Bill says no more than 100 new members will be accepted a year. FlexJet has about 3,000 customers, and NetJet also has thousands. Not all are fractional owners. Both companies offer ways to fly private without ownership. Steve Peglua, a former chairman of Bain Capital, was among the first 110 members of Bond, all of whom are also investors in the company. Each invested between $500,000 and $2.5 million. Pegula, who now runs his family office in Palm Beach, Florida, says he liked the company's intimate approach to fractional ownership. The model has proven to be financially viable, but it's now built on mass demand and massive scale, he says. I invested in Bond because I believe in the concept of a custom experience over scale. Private jet pools. WhatsApp and group text have become common ways for the well-connected to trade seats on private planes. Some companies are now offering a formalized version of this if-you-know-you-know chats. They include JetLynx, a private aviation company founded in 1999. Recently, JetLynx introduced a program allowing its 2,000-plus members to advertise open seats on flights to other members. It's a way for people going to the same place to jet pool instead of taking multiple individual flights. I don't want to call it a dating app, but it's a little like doing some matchmaking, says JetLynx executive chairman Jamie Walker. A newer company in the jet pool business is Revere, founded by Harrison Epstein, who pivoted to aviation after a 15-year finance career, and Luke Denise, Diplo's former tour manager. Epstein says Revere's aims to be the middle between the 1,000 first class seat and the 10,000 an hour charter. The idea struck him at where else? An airport. When he was waiting for a commercial flight and saw a private jet idling on the tarmac. I'd pay to get on that right now and get home, he recalled thinking. Revere, its pitch is a members club that splits private flights between customers traveling similar routes. The cost is a one-time sign-up fee of $2,500, which Revere plans to replace with an annual fee in 2027. Members then pay per flight, with pricing varying widely but starting at around $4,000. What you get? Domestic and international flights on planes from companies including VistaJet and Baker Aviation. To get flights, members book commercial tickets or submit route requests. Revere notifies them when private flights match their itinerary. The company expects members to modify their own commercial travel if need be. Sometimes flights are shared, other times members fly solo, like when their itinerary aligns with that of an empty jet. The majority of Ned McPherson's Revere flights have been solos, he says. McPherson, a marketing strategist in Miami, uses the company to book one of the 4 to 5 flights he takes monthly. Revere has traded off, he says, Oftentimes, you will find a great opportunity in terms of price, but it's only a one way. It's not as common to find both there and back. Here's another kind of airport, the Uber approach. When Uber co-founder Garrett Camp started his aviation venture, Aero, in 2021, he bought elements of the rideshare company to the world of private jets, namely accessibility. Like Uber, anyone can use Aero. There is no membership fee or application process. You book passage on one of the 7 jets, a mixture of Gulfstreams and Embracers that seat between 8 and 16 using its app or site. In Aero, the pitch is a website or app any traveler can freely use to get a seat on a select private flight shared with others. The prices vary, but roughly average about $1,000 per hour of flight time. What you get: most domestic routes between wealthy enclaves like Los Angeles, New York, Miami, Aspen, Colorado, and Maui. The Aero CEO, Ben Klein, said it targeted customers including that second homeowner traveling frequently, also among pet owners. Being able to bring your dog is a huge advantage, and why not? Where lots of people choose Aero. Elisa Levy frequent books Aero flights between her homes in Los Angeles and Aspen. She said the company makes it easy to modify reservations and that it accommodates various luggage. You can bring difficult items like a bike, said Levy, a retiree. We've bought framed paintings in a box. The private oasis for commercial flyers. A basic draw of private jet travel is avoiding chaotic commercial airports. That is what PS specializes in. Anyone with a commercial ticket can book its private terminals at major airports in Los Angeles, Miami, Dallas, and Atlanta. PS facilities have shared lounges and private suites, as well as their own TSA agents. Customers are often greeted with champagne and caviar and pampered with gourmet meals and massage treatments. When it's time to board your flight, a driver whisks you directly to the plane in a BMW. The pitch is a network of private terminals at select U.S. airports where commercial travelers can check in and wait for flights away from the masses. An annual membership fee ranges from $1,250 to $4,800. Members then pay per booking, starting at $895. Non-members can also book terminals starting at $1,295 per visit. What you get: TSA with no lines and other amenities, including massages and being chauffeured to your commercial plane. Savan Parekh, the CEO of a tech company in New York, got a free PS booking through his credit card. He wasn't sure if he'd paid to go back. For the cost of entry for his family, he might rather book a suite at a luxury hotel instead, or you can stay there for 3 hours before your flight, he says. Joshua Davis, a concierge stylist and PS member in Atlanta, appreciates the company's small touches, like the refrigerator filled with bottled matcha, juices, and water waiting just past security. While PS users' final destinations are commercial flights, the company is banking on travelers splurging for a few hours away from the masses. Privacy is a kind of the ultimate luxury, says PS CEO Amina Porter. You are listening to the reading of articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the fashion page, why women should wear chunky watches. Slim watches are prized for their delicacy, but big ones convey a different kind of femininity. Here's how one fan pulls it off. And this is by Rachel Perry. At the Watches and Wonders show I attended earlier this year, including brands Bulgaria, Felipe, Piaget, and Hermes rolled out tiny new timepieces or smaller versions of similar models. It was the fair's biggest little trend. The 40-millimeter stainless steel and black Rolex Submariner on my wrist made me sense I was out of step with what was in style. That chunkier watch, my ideal size, was the same one worn by my dad. Though less enormous than others, it still takes over my wrist. Its heft conveys steadiness, nerve, and a certain presence. Where I wear the watch, it enters a room a fraction of the second before I do. Even as some companies are pushing scaled-down versions into the spotlight, other brands have resisted the shrinkage taking over the industry. Known for pieces with grand proportions, Panerai's smallest watches measures 38 millimeters from one side of the face to the other, a size many competitors would still call big. A representative for the brand told me that many of its female clients are gravitating towards even heftier models, some with cases as large as 44 millimeter. I understand why those women would choose watches that size. If diminutive watches function as a tasteful punctuation mark, chunky ones announce a desire to be feminine without being delicate. Think of them like statement shoes, a single accessory that can add personality to simple outfits. I like to wear mine over the cuff of a dress shirt, almost like a bangle, or with clothes that play up the tension between feminine and masculine. An oversized button-down layered over a t-shirt with a full midi skirt and ballet flats, for example, or a sleek ankle-length dress. There is something alluring between the juxtaposition of a large diving watch against a streamlined LBB and heels, particularly when you have no intention of descending any deeper into a subway station. I had a selection of substantial watches sleek enough to wear every day. Now, there's a great big watch, but it's pretty expensive. It has an Arabic dial watch. It has Arabic numbers instead of English numbers. It sells for $2,750, and it measures 41 millimeters. Here is a Seiko, and again, this time the numbers are Roman numerals, and it's the Japanese garden watch. It sells for $650, and it's 41.8 millimeters across. Even bigger is a 42 millimeter one, which is a chronographic annual edition watch, and it is 42 millimeters wide, but the price is $10,000. Still bigger is a 43 millimeter watch. It's a Timex, and it's Harborside Coast multifunction watch, and it has a good price of $150. It has 1, 2, 3 different sections on the face, and it doesn't have any numbers. It just has symbols. The biggest is a 44 millimeter watch, and it's a Panerai Luminator Marine watch, and it is again pricey. It sells for $9,500, and it's 44 millimeters wide at the face. It has a 12, a 9, and a 6 for their numbers. From the food and drink page, I traded coffee for energy drinks and nearly lost my mind. Inside my work week buzzing on Celsius and other caffeine-loaded beverages that promise to help drinkers optimize their lives. And this is by Jamie Waters. I have such a high caffeine tolerance, I announced to my partner as I cracked open a can of Celsius. These probably won't really affect me. I'm a coffee addict. As an Australian, it's required by law. I down 3 iced lattes daily, a habit I refuse to break even as my bank account groans. But lately, it's become impossible to ignore the siren call of energy drinks. Walk into most grocery stores or gyms, and you'll find a wall of sleek cans with the caffeine of roughly 3 espresso shots, zero sugar, sans serif pledges to accelerate metabolism. These aren't the monsters or the Red Bulls of gas stations and skydivers past. Dynamite wrapped in chic pastel, they provide ammunition for a day of pulverizing emails and crushing reformer Pilates. In a culture obsessed with optimization, these drinks are here to help you everything max while embracing wellness vibes. Live Fit declared the Celsius cans. Bloom, another energy drink, promised to make you bloom into your best self. These days, you're as likely to see hashtag clean living West Village girl clutching a can of rocket fuel as you mount your BMX daredevil or a nocturnal gamer. Energy drinks have been multi-leisured. A Celsius is productive symbol in my eyes, says Natalie Boach, 27, a publicist in New York. I'm like, I have a can and I'll get the job done. Energy drinks are more popular than ever. Sales were up by 42% in 2025 from 2021, according to the Beverage Diet Fact Book. Celsius and its sister's brand, NU stands for nutrition, led a wave of trendy beverages that fit into the broader demand for functional products like protein bars and Zyn nicotine pouches. I don't think this is a fad, says Bonnie Herzog, a senior analyst covering beverages at Goldman Sachs. Aside from a couple of regrettable Red Bull vodkas in college, I'd never consumed energy drinks. But the only thing I love more than coffee is winning. And I was worried all those glowing, hyper-efficient millennials were getting a leg up. So for 1 week, I traded my beloved lattes for cans from a range of brands. I drank 16 and a half in total. By midweek, I nearly lost my mind. Zero sugar, maximum caffeine. If you were recruiting someone to sell a wellness product, my gym instructor would be an excellent choice. Tan, toned, twinkle in his eye, he looks like he should be handing out roses on The Bachelor. So when, class after class, I saw this picture of vitality sipping a sparkling kiwi guava Celsius, I thought, only half jokingly, maybe that will turn me into that. It's only made sense to start with his preferred flavor. I took a swig and was struck by the jaw-clenching sweetness. It evoked kiwis and guavas like Twizzlers do strawberries. Afterwards, my teeth felt a bit fuzzy. But I was buzzing. The caffeine hit me harder than coffee does. I could have cartwheeled down the corridor. Instead, I typed some emails very quickly. I assumed I could drink one Celsius for every double shot latte I typically consumed. Nope, they're too loaded with caffeine. A 12-ounce can of Celsius or Ani Nu contains 200 milligrams, a little less than 2 Red Bulls or 5 Diet Cokes, and about 50 to 80 milligrams more than each of my lattes. Celsius labels state not to drink more than 2 cans a day. There's a lack of education about the impact these drinks have on our bodies, says Amy Stevens, a sports and eating disorder dietitian. Dr. Rika Kumar, associate professor of clinical medicine at Weill Cornell Medicine, said most healthy adults can consume up to 400 milligrams of caffeine a day. Research supports the idea that coffee doesn't just make you more alert. It has anti-inflammatory, neoprotective, and metabolic benefits too. We have 50 years of safety data on coffee, she added. We have excellent marketing data on Celsius. If you haven't heard, these don't contain a scrap of sugar. They're spiked with sucrose, a artificial sweetener that, according to the Food and Drug Administration, is about 600 times sweeter than table sugar. Nutrition labels don't disclose sucrose quantities, but this year federal health officials recommend limiting intake of artificial sweeteners. New guidelines accompany a government report citing research that links sugar substitutes to conditions such as cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes. Zero sugar doesn't mean metabolically neutral, Kumar says. A Celsius spokesperson said that sucrose has been determined safe for intended uses by the FDA. For most of these drinks, the artificial flavors linger in my mouth after I drain the can. Then I tried Anhui Nu's cotton candy, which made the others seem like green juices in comparison. Kyle Watson, the chief brand officer for Celsius Holdings, said it's the most popular flavor. It might be the sweetest thing I've ever tasted and was the only drink I couldn't finish. Still, hot pink bubbles on the can suggest a guilt-free treat. Zero sugar, B vitamins, gluten-free. When I asked Watson if she considered the brand's drinks to be wellness products, she said no, adding, "We are a choice people look to when looking for energy that is premium with zero sugar. We have essential vitamins," Watson called it, functional maxing. On the moon, Jeff Drawl, a fit 35-year-old who owns a snack food company in Los Angeles, is careful about what he consumes: meats, vegetables, rice, and Celsius. He drinks them purely because they provide a sharper kick than anything else he's tried. Coffee and caffeine pills, he says, do not give me the same mental clarity. If you also drink these solely for energy and not for some supposed wellness benefit they deliver. On several occasions, I felt like my brain had been elbowed awake. Admittedly, this was often tempered by a headache, which Kumar says may have been triggered by a variation in caffeine dose from my usual coffee order and slightly sore teeth. I'm a sleepy guy and I experienced a natural dip several hours after drinking these, like I do with coffee. I had no trouble sleeping. Two particular drinks made me feel most like my preppy gym instructor. Joggy Solar mango flavor was refreshing, like lightly flavored sparkling water. It was the rare drink that contained sugar from fruit juice instead of sucrose. My favorite Celsius that's not too sweet is peach mango green tea. Put springs in my sneakers when I'm down it for a run. One afternoon, halfway through the week, I realized why people get hooked on these. After crushing two Celsiuses in 4 hours, I reached a state that could be called euphoric. I had no idea what flavor the cosmic vibe one was evoking beyond red, very sweet. But by the time I finished it, I couldn't have cared less. I was on the moon. I soared through a pitch meeting. I wasn't exactly jittery, but I was able to open my eyes extra wide. I swear my hair got bigger too, but that may have just been a coincidence. A few days later, I was back on planet Earth sipping lattes. I ditched the cans, not because I'm an angel about what I ingest. I just miss the taste of coffee and the way it makes me feel. We're not talking about Evel Knievel here. For a guy who works from a swivel chair, I'm basically function maxing already. You are listening to the reading of articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And here's an article from the Food and Drink page. We quizzed readers about regional American foods. They told us what we missed. Responding to a quiz by our food columnist, readers shared favorite local delicacies from across the country. And this is by Adam Chandler. The Sloppy Joe at Town Hall Delicatessen in South Orange, New Jersey, isn't the textbook version you're probably imagining. It doesn't come on a school-issued bun, nor does it come with the staining might of tomato sauce and ground beef. Instead, it's a double-decker sandwich with two deli meats, Swiss cheese, coleslaw, and Russian dressing, all layered intricately between slices of thin rye bread. For a sliver of North New Jersey, it is the canonical sloppy joe. Despite living only 20 miles away, I had no clue it existed until recently, when a few passionate fans wrote to me about the sandwich in response to a quiz about regional American foods that I put together last month. Delicious but not for the faint-hearted was how Damon Lavelle, a reader in Morristown, New Jersey, described the New Jersey sloppy joe, which legend has it was inspired by a sandwich at a bar called Sloppy Joe's in Havana, Cuba. It was one of the several dishes people wrote to me about that weren't mentioned in the quiz. Iowa Made Rights and Rhode Island Johnny Cakes. Some, like made rights or loose meat sandwiches, as they are known in Iowa, were familiar to me. Staples at taverns across the state made rights more closely resembled the sloppy dough of school lunchrooms. The ground beef sandwiches are served on a soft bun topped with mustard, pickle, and raw onions. Johnny Cakes, Rhode Island's famous cornmeal pancakes, were another dish mentioned by readers that I have gotten to enjoy. My family has roots in the state, so I know that Johnny Cakes is the preferred spelling by some purist. Midwestern casseroles. Some Ohioans have been adamant that I try their state's Johnny dish, the Johnny Maserati, a decadent casserole with ground beef, sausage, pasta, tomato sauce, and cheese. Linked to Columbus, Ohio, it is representative of the broader casserole culture in the Midwest and a main course that could be followed by a second Ohio delicacy readers told me about. Buckeyes, the state's fudgy peanut butter and chocolate sweet. Those are amazing. Another Midwestern casserole praised by more than one reader was the hot dish, Minnesota's official comfort food with no official recipe. Most versions call for ground beef, vegetables, can of condensed cream soup, mushroom or chicken, and tater tot topping, but it's also served deep fried on a stick at the Minnesota's annual state fair. Kentucky buckaroo stew and Hawaiian lahulalu. Fried foods featured in my quiz included the fried pork tenderloin sandwich, which was popularized in Indiana. Louise Hale, a reader in Davenport, Ohio, pointed out that it has crossed state lines, directing me to the version from the filling station, a restaurant near her home. It's common for the pork to be at least two times the size of the bun, she said, adding that the filling station version could easily fill two buns with pork hanging over. Hale's also told me about burgo, a slow-cooked Kentucky stew. Historically, it was made with any protein a household could hunt. Nowadays, recipes typically involve chicken, pork, beef, and a medley of vegetables. The furthest-flung food mentioned in the buffet of emails I received was luau, Hawaii's pork and fish dish that is wrapped and steamed in taro leaves. As much as I wanted to hop on a plane from New York to try it, my editor and I settled on a shorter trek to New Jersey to start with its sloppy dough. Like many of America's regional dishes, the Garden State sandwich feels stubbornly fixed in tradition. While popular versions use turkey, roast beef, pastrami, and other deli meats, the original version on offer at the 99-year-old Town Hall Delicatessen is still made with ham and beef tongue. The latter is increasingly hard to find these days, and that's exactly what made the trip worth it. From the design page, how a mid-century home was saved after a bad 1980s renovation. Removing the 80s-era renovation allowed a Nevada home original architecture to take center stage. And this is by Kelsey Mulvey. Laura and Brent Harsh's mid-century style house in Nevada near Lake Tahoe was built in the 1970s. But when the couple bought the home in 2019, much of its charm had been lost to a 1980s renovation involving shades of bay and lot of dynasty-era mirrors. The home before was piecemeal together, said Laura, a former educator who now helps her attorney husband run his legal office. It was a strange layout and not functional. The specs, it was built in 1972. The location is Nevada, about 45 minutes from Lake Tahoe. It is, the main house is 3,898 square feet. It has 3 bedrooms and 3.5 bathrooms. Renovation time, it took about 3 years. The couple had initially been attracted to the house for its welcoming feeling. That was a quantity that the Harshes, who have 2 teenage children, wanted to retain. They sought out an interior designer to restore the residence to its former glory while introducing modern touches that complemented its low slung profile and angular roofline. For the job, they hired Chloe Lagarce of Boxwood Avenue Interiors, who design firms have offices in Reno, Nevada, and Paris. Her first step, removing the 80s era renovation to allow the home's original architecture to take center stage. I look at the bones so that the interior feels unified, Largus says. Here's a room-by-room breakdown of the revamp, which took about 3 years to complete. The atrium. Raised planters original to the home's atrium were a big inspiration for the entire renovation. The greenery of the plants set the mood, Largus says. We wanted to incorporate an indoor-outdoor feeling, but the planters' pale, slump-stone sides made them look dated. They covered them with high-density fiber cement panels topped with black granite, about $22,000 in material. A project overseen by MD Construction, a custom home builder in Tupic, California. The living room. We wanted comfort, Laura said. Everything that we selected needed to fill the desire of a good, homey feeling. A walnut flank ceiling helped cozy up the living room. It really grounded the space and helped give the home a nestled feeling, Margus said. The dining room and the kitchen. A dark wood of the living room extended to the adjacent dining room as well as to the home's kitchen. Both spaces featured sculptor Jamie Maxwell Winterbert lights, $42,000 for the dining room fixtures, as well as celebratory windows and skylights. Largus designed each with the Harshes' day-to-day routines in mind, especially meals with their children. The kitchen needed to be incredibly functional because they love to cook and spend time together, Largus said. The whole goal from the beginning was to restore it, Largus said. When you walk in this home, you feel like you can just breathe. They changed everything. They seemed to change all of the light colors and the light wood into dark wood in all of the rooms of the house. You're listening to the reading of articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the Rumble Seat by Dan Neal, America's favorite compact SUV just ditched the gas-only option. By eliminating gas-only models and fixing a few hybrid annoyances, Toyota's RAV4 proves that improved fuel economy doesn't mean sacrificing performance. Again, by Dan Neal. You want relevant? Here it is, folks, the one that matters. Our guest represents the sixth design generation of the Toyota RAV4 subcompact SUV, the perennial sales leader in its segment and one of the best-selling, most trusted family vehicles in the U.S. Bentleys and Lotuses are fun for a few, but the RAV4 owns the love of multitudes. The newsy bit, as of model year 2026, all RAV4s are hybrid RAV4s. Toyota has eliminated the gas-only option. The new RAV4 HEV gets a boost in poke, 336 miles and 326 with four-wheel drive, compared to the outgoing hybrid. The other figure of merit, 43 miles per gallon combined for the four-wheel drive. Not bad for a vehicle from the Yeti Cooler School of Design. Built around a 2.5-liter inline-four Edison cycle gas engine, RAV4's hybrid system employs a dual planetary gear set and electronically controlled CVT and two integrated electric motors, one dedicated mostly to propulsion and the other regenerated braking charging of the battery. All-wheel drive models have an independent electric motor on the rear axle for an on-demand all-wheel drive. The RAV4 PHEV, ours in the Woodland Gray, sells for $47,850 as tested. Debuts the company's largest plug-in hybrid iteration. PHEV models come standard with all-wheel drive. By way of an independent e-motor on the rear axle, raising system output to a lofty 324 miles per hour. Here the magic number is all electric range, an EPA estimated 52 miles. With the more intrepid Woodland, that number falls to 49 miles due to the added drag of the all-terrain tires. As much as I hate to quibble about with the EPA, I easily beat that number during two drain-the-battery type tests in mixed city and highway driving using normal drive mode. These were quality EV miles, too. Typically, PHEVs fire up the engine if the car exceeds the speed or load threshold, or if the traction battery falls below a minimum state of charge, or if the driver asks for full power, even momentarily. This narrow window of operation makes it hard for commuters to take advantage of the PHEV's efficiency, and it really pisses me off. The RAV4 PHEV's EV mode was completely transparent, that is to say, all but indistinguishable from the operation of a regular battery electric. In fact, I found myself humming along the interstate at 80 miles an hour, anticipating, even dreading the moment the gas engine refired. But as the miles of EV range counted down to zero, it never did. Finally, the drive mode icon in the instrument display turned from EV mode to hybrid mode. That was a sign that the 2.5-liter engine under the hood had been activated. But breezing along at 80 miles an hour, I couldn't hear the engine start, or could I feel it running. Wow, this thing is dead quiet, I thought, and why is my inner voice shouting? Given the price point, I was prepared for some cost-driven choices in the cabin materials and amenities. Toyota did not disappoint. The seats were hard and flat. The audio system is just okay, but the cabin isolation, quiet and refined, are next level. Whatever engine droning and snoozing you might remember from earlier CVT systems has been banished to the Phantom Zone. I also wanted to acknowledge the heroes who delivered on high-speed wind noise. The squarish contours offer 1,000 places for whistling and buffling to hide. And yet, at 80 miles an hour, wind noise is reduced to a lulling hush. At lower speeds, as in city traffic, you begin to hear the engines whispering, revving in the perpetual background as it simultaneously propels the car and recharges the 22.7 kilowatt battery. But unless you are a practiced safe cracker, you can't feel it cycling on and off. Put a pin in that. Our woodsy friend is ridiculously quick. With the help of two torquey e-motors, the PHEV comes off the line smartly in EV mode. By the seat of my pants, 0 to 60 mile per hour acceleration feels like 9 seconds, give or take. With the IC motor engaged, the pace picks up heroically. Toyota cites a 0 to 60 miles per hour acceleration in 5.4 seconds, gas plus electric, which would make the workday REV PHEV quicker than the Porsche Macan T. Another way the REV4 PHEV is conspicuously above the line: suspension tuning. The front McPherson struts and rear multi-link have been upgraded and thoroughly gentrified. The ride and road holding compromise is well stuck, with road impacts well damped and muffled, and transient body motion kept in check. The all-terrain tires undo some of its good work. The taller sidewalls mean more deflection and sharp cornering, a less crisp steering response, and a bit more tire noise at highway speeds, but not bad. I have thoughts. It seems obvious that after a couple of years of American public guessing about stop-start systems in their cars, Toyota decided to make the problem go away by making the experience go away. Stop, start, when? Do you hear something? No, you did not. I kind of love that. The maximum effort on NVH also reflects the special challenges involved in engineering a mass product PHEV. In conventional IC-powered cars, the running engine helps mask a host of other unwanted sounds. In an EV, or even in a PHEV that spends much of its life in EV mode, those noises step to the experimental foreground. In response, the sixth generation RAV4 was issued an upgrade acoustic armor. Complaints? The RAV4 is too modern suburbia what pork pie hats were to 50s dads. Everybody's got one. Few really look cool wearing them. I tried counting all the RAV4s I saw on the way to the park about 15 minutes away. I gave up when I hit 50, and I was nowhere near the park. I can hardly believe one of the most popular vehicles in America is so dumb looking. The Woodland grade comes with a split hammerhead grill. Grrr, says the Woodland. I'm a bear. I'm a shark. I'm a shark bear. The Woodland also comes equipped with CCS1 charging port with DC fast charging capabilities, allowing charging from 10% to 80% in 35 minutes under ideal conditions, says Toyota. That will literally never happen. Users who aspire to recover the PHEV premium, which sells for $9,600, will have to arrange for home charging, but not much. My humble level 2 32 amp charger had fully recharged the Toyota by the time I got up in the morning, when it again became relevant. The price as tested, what I had already said, was $47,850. It's a plug-in hybrid gas electric using a direct injection. There's an exclusive by Ford. Ford plans a four-door version of the Mustang. The design would be first for the automaker's pony car and possibly broaden its consumer appeal. And this is by Christopher Otts and Ryan Felton. Ford Motor has told car dealers it intends to produce a four-door gas-powered version of the Mustang for the first time, adding a variant to the pony car that has sold in the millions since 1964, according to people familiar with the matter. The four-door Mustang was shown at a dealer event this year, the people said. It could go on sale before the close of this decade and resemble the current two-door Mustang, one of the people said. Two of the people said the car would have hybrid power. One of the people said it would be a hybrid V8. We do not comment or speculate about future products, a Ford spokesman said. Ford has previously shown a version of the four-door vehicle at an internal event in June, according to another person familiar with the matter. Products plans can change before production. Ford in recent years has canceled other future models, including an electric SUV with three rows of seats. The move to expand the normally two-door Mustang, one of the most famous American cars of all time and a fixture of pop culture and motorsports, comes as Ford seeks to double down on what it calls its most passionate vehicles. Yet Ford has been increasingly interested in sedans, a vehicle category that Detroit automakers has ceded to foreign competitors such as Toyota and Honda. Ford has been looking at how to re-enter the sedan segment while ensuring the vehicles make money, Chief Executive Jim Farley said earlier this year. The original Mustang was so popular that its then young baby boomer audience that it launched an entire generation of similarly American performance cars. The Mustang has also been noted as outstanding in as many competitors. The Chevy Camaro was discontinued in 2023. The Dodge Charger and Challenger disappeared from the market for decades before their 2000s revival. Dodge parent Stellantis relaunched the Charger last year as a gas-powered model after introducing a poor-selling all-electric Charger in 2024. The Charger comes in two-door and four-door versions. Through the decades, the Mustang nameplate has always been applied to two-door coupes and convertibles, save for some internal prototypes and design studies that Ford never put into production. The lone exception has been the Mustang Mach-E, a performance-focused electric crossover SUV that Ford counts as a separate model. The Mustang remains the world's best-selling sports car, but like many such vehicles, the Mustang has seen its sales decline in recent years as buyers shift to more practical vehicles. Ford sold more than 122,000 Mustangs in the U.S. in 2015, compared to 45,000 last year. The current Mustang lineup ranges from a four-cylinder coupe that starts at about $33,000 to a high-end performance coupe that tops $100,000. Adding a four-door version could broaden the model's appeal to a wider audience, including families seeking more space than the coupe can offer. Other automakers have branched out in similar ways in recent decades. Porsche, a brand famous for its sports cars, now counts SUVs as its top-selling model. From the food and drink page, my quest for a wine that pairs with everything ended with this sub-$30 bottle, and this is by Jason Williams. People make a bigger deal out of wine and food pairings than they need to. My simple rule, find a Goldilocks wine, not too heavy, not too light, and stick with it. I discovered mine years ago when attempting to find the perfect pairing with radicchio, that notoriously challenged purple leafy vegetable known for its aggressive bitterness, earthiness, and astringency. A bottle of young Italian Nebbiolo was up to the task. Its rambunctious tannins, high acidity, and contrasting notes of cherry, rose petal, and hot summer asphalt work nicely. A wine that pairs with radicchio will pair with pretty much anything. I had found my Goldilocks. Nebbiolo, a grape grown mainly in the southern Piedmont region, combines the finesse and complexity of Pinot Noir with the power and tannins of Cabernet Sauvignon. It carries enough bright acid to pair with grilled meats and creamy pasta sauces, enough earthiness to complement mushrooms and truffles, and a savoriness that plays well with roasted veggies and herb-heavy dishes. Untrendy and rarely touted by influencers or celebrity sommeliers, Nebbiolo, I will spell that for you, Nebbiolo, has flown under the radar in part because it's poor cousins of two more coveted expensive wines, Barolo and Barbesco, are both made from the Nebbiolo grape. Those premium bottles are distinguished by their age. Barolo must age for at least 38 months before release, where Barbesco must age a minimum of 26 months. Most Nebbiolo wines are aged less than a year, allowing makers to use grapes from younger vineyards or difficult vintages, but that doesn't mean they are less appealing. The wine is also significantly less expensive than other Nebbiolos. While most top Barolos start at about $80 and plenty go for over $150, Nebbiolos from the exact same producers nearly run less than $30 and often under $25. It's why many people refer to Nebbiolo as baby Barolo. Another reason this moderately priced, easy to drink wine hasn't made its big time in the overused 100 point scale that wine critics use. They seem to follow an unwritten rule that Nebbiolo must always be rated between 87 and 89 points in order to leave room for the 95-point Barolos. If Nebbiolo were reviewed in any other context where price and value mattered, it would never be rated that low. To put my theory to the test, I've been sharing bottles of Nebbiolo with friends over the past few months. I've served it with skirt steak, pork tenderloin, salmon, eggplant-driven pasta a la Norma, and risotto made with fresh, ripe Jersey tomatoes. Even the wine collectors among my friends who swear by hyped Barolos have had to admit that on a summer evening, an accompaniment to a delicious meal and lively conversation, the Nebbiolo hits just right. You have been listening to the reading of articles and features from Saturday, Sunday, August 8th and 9th issue of Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal. We read from Off Duty every Saturday at 8 p.m. Your reader has been Patricia Mary. Thank you for listening. God bless and be safe out there.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have Sports Illustrated. Following that at 10 o'clock is The Athletic, and at 11 o'clock is episode number 11 of Had a Call Boogie by James Lee Burke. Stay with us for these readings and more. following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability.